The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
Hello, my friends. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. So let's open up today's show with a headline that I saw earlier this week. It's at redstate.com, and the headline is, Trump pushes birther theory about Nikki Haley, claiming she is not a natural-born citizen. And as you read the article, it basically says, President Trump has started to view former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley as a primary threat in the bid to win Republican presidential nomination. I don't believe anybody's a threat, but that's just me. And so as her support grows in the polls, and I think the left wing of the Republican Party, working with the Democrat Party, is pushing her to the front. They would rather her be president. That way, if somehow, some way, the cheat was overrun by the Republican vote, they still have one of their own in there. I mean, she's a World Economic Forum stooge, in my opinion, but that isn't what the article is about, so we'll stop right there. So Trump posted on social media implying that Haley is not a natural-born citizen, which means she cannot become president. In the post, what he did is he posted a report from the Gateway Pundit, which is a website I like to go to quite a bit, propagating the notion that Haley might not be eligible for the presidency because of her parents' citizenship status when she was born. The Gateway Pundit report discusses an op-ed written for American Greatness by author Paul Ingracia, arguing that Haley, despite being born in the United States, does not meet the threshold for being a natural-born citizen. Here's a part of that article. It makes sense that the constitutional framers did not license the presidency to anyone born on U.S. soil. The specific requirement of natural-born citizenship, which is absent for both members of Congress and the judiciary, was intended to raise the threshold for presidential office holders in particular. In Nikki Haley's case, it is well documented that neither one of her parents were citizens, natural-born or naturalized, at the time of her birth in 1972. It has been previously reported that a South Carolina-based newspaper included a quote from the office of Nikki Haley stating that her parents were not U.S. citizens at the time of her birth in 1972 and did not become citizens until 1978 and 2003. Thus, although the parents may have been lawful residents at the time of her birth on South Carolina soil, which would make her a citizen, which may or may not confer with her the privileges of citizenship, it is important to note that she does not qualify for the Constitution's higher requirement of natural-born citizen. The writer is correct. In fact, I am a part of a lawsuit that has kind of been lost in the weeds at the writ of certiori with the Supreme Court. Supreme Court seems to have ignored it, alleging that Kamala Harris is not eligible for vice president because neither one of her parents were citizens at the time of her birth. Her mother was Indian and her father was Jamaican. They were students. They were actually here on student visas. So there's a deeper concern there. But so natural born citizen is one born on U.S. soil, or they may not happen. But what we're being told is that natural born citizen simply is someone who did not have to go through the naturalization process. So in other words, they are naturally citizens. That's the argument. Birthright citizenship. If that was the case, if that was the correct argument, then in Article 2, when it talks about natural-born citizen, why would it separate citizen and natural-born citizen? If being a citizen who's born here is enough, then that's what they would have said. But that's not, they didn't say native citizen. They didn't say citizen born on American soil. They put natural born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. Well, all of these guys were citizens. Most of them were born on the soil. But there were no natural born citizens yet because the country had only been a country since 1776. So in order to be born of citizen parents, well, the oldest natural born citizen, if the definition that you had to be born of citizen parents, well, the oldest one was 11 years old at the time of the writing of the Constitution. So there's a separation between citizen and natural born citizen right there on the pages of the Constitution, explaining to us that they are two different things. Birthright citizenship will tell you they're one and the same. If you are a native citizen, then you are a natural born citizen. And that's just not true. The article goes on to say that Trump's social media post harkens back to the claims that former President Barack Obama was also not an American citizen, which would have disqualified him from office if true. He was disqualified by his own admission. His father was not a citizen. Problem was, everybody kept chasing after whether or not he was born in Hawaii, and where he was born was not the issue as much as who his parents were. The article that's being referred to goes on to read this. A recent survey showed Haley closely trailing DeSantis with only days left until the Iowa caucus. According to the Hill Decision Desk HQ polling average, Trump leads the GOP field in Iowa with 51.6% support. DeSantis follows with 18%. Haley closely trails with 17.1%, which is higher than what she was before. It would also be great for someone to outperform expectations in Iowa, and right now Trump's expectations are a resounding win, said Matthew Bartlett, a New Hampshire-based Republican strategist. GOP strategists say New Hampshire and Haley's home state of South Carolina will likely be more important to her path forward. As polls show, Haley with a stronger lead over DeSantis in those locations. Even better for Haley is the latest real clear polling average showing that she is slightly leading the Florida governor at 16.6% to 16.4%. According to members of Team Haley, the candidate is hoping to pull off a powerful performance in Iowa. Her objective is to make a strong showing in Iowa and New Hampshire instead of trying to outright win the races, which would be nearly impossible given former President Trump's healthy lead over the rest of the field. And understand, these candidates for president, they know they can't beat Trump. It's a audition for vice president. That's what it is, but that's beside the point. The article goes on to say if Trump does not break 50%, that's going to be significant. And where Nikki comes in and how close is going to be critical, Bartlett said. If she can make this a competitive race at the start here in New Hampshire and give Donald Trump a shock, that shock therapy to the campaign should ultimately change the dynamic of this race and make it more competitive coming out of New Hampshire. So with Haley's support growing, Trump's team could be anticipating the possibility that she might unseat Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as the primary threat to the former president. The Republican frontrunner still maintains a healthy lead over the rest of the pack. However, it is worth noting that other developments could impact Trump's chances of winning the GOP nod, aside from the cheat, I mean, especially if the attacks on him legally worsen to the point that the base begins to start seeking an alternative. I think the base understands that it's just an attack and it's a bunch of garbage. Haley could be better positioned if the base gets nervous about all these attacks judicially and be better positioned to win the nomination if she plays her cards right. That's according to the writer. So I don't think she can catch him. I think she's auditioning for vice president, or at least some position in the Trump administration should Trump be elected and be able to overcome the cheat. I do believe that his popularity is greater than it's ever been. I think the votes he receives can be greater than 2016, and I believe he won in a landslide in 2016. He's going to win in a greater landslide now, but they will cheat. They will do everything they can to try to stop him. So the question is, will it overcome that? But get back to the original point. So Nikki Haley not having parents that were born in the United States is not eligible. Neither is Vivek Ramaswamy, for that matter. All right, that's our opening story. Let's go on now to our next thing. Now, here's one that might catch your attention. I have a friend, Alan Myers, on For the Republic, and does this segment called Wackadoodle News, and I guess this would fit into it. And the purpose of me bringing this up is not to convince you that the story is accurate or not accurate. It's to it's to show the condition of our culture at the moment. So a little over a week ago, this story broke in Miami. And it's all over the social media and the TikTokers and all this other stuff that at the Miami Mall, there was this situation where anywhere from 60 to 100 cops showed up to handle the situation in the mall, and how it's being reported by the Miami police, and I have no reason to doubt their report, other than the fact that we often get lied to, but that's beside the point. According to the report by the Miami police, there was about 50 teenagers that had been causing a ruckus. They were firing fireworks and things like that into the inside the mall, and so there was concern, and all these police came in to get this riot under control. So, and they've arrested like four of them so far. But what emerged on the internet, what grew on the internet was not that story. Because there were, according to people in social media, there were some people who reported seeing between 8 foot and 10 foot tall beings in the mall. And some of the people who were armed began shooting at these aliens to protect themselves, protect their families, whatever. And the mayhem that got, well, that was created out is what brought the police in. This is the Bayside Marketplace Mall in Miami. So according to the police, it was like 50 teenagers. They sparked a riot. They were running through the corridor, shooting fireworks, damaging stores, and starting fights. And so this is what we're being told. Now, this was on New Year's Day. So, what, 2 weeks ago? All right, so that's the story. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up, the reason why it's important, I don't know if there was 8 to 10 foot tall beings walking through the mall and creating mayhem and people responding and reacting and so on and so forth. I really don't know. But what I do know is that we have a society that is on the lookout for something like that. That our culture has gotten so bad that the loss of virtue in our culture has gotten to the point we've turned our back on God enough where people are beginning to look for signs that this is the end of days, that this is the end times. And one of the signs that we expect, because this is what Jesus told us, was that in those days it would be like the days of Noah. And when you talk about the days of Noah, the days of Noah were similar to Sodom and Gomorrah in the sense that there was the drink and then being merry and the homosexuality and all that other stuff that was going on, sinful behavior and so on and so forth, which has been cyclical throughout human history. You see it bubble up and then die down, and bubble up and die down, and we're seeing it bubble up again today when it comes to the behavior of certain persons in our culture. Now, that said, there was something else going on during the days of Noah. If you go to chapter 6 of Genesis, it says that Noah was chosen because he was pure in his generations. In other words, there was no mixture in his DNA. In those days, demons took human form, came down to the earth, and married and made children with human women. And what that did is that mixed demonic DNA, angelic DNA with human DNA. And that's where it created giants. You know, when you got David and Goliath, for example, Goliath being related to the Nephilim. And so if the end times are going to be as the days of Noah, then there will be giants. We're expecting giants. And this is what people are seeing or thought they saw or may have saw or believe they saw or said they saw. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Once again, I'm not suggesting that the story out of Miami says one or the other. I'm just, it's fascinating that this is even a discussion. And what it does is it tells us that either something really weird's going on, or we're expecting something really weird to go on. Where Nephilim is the Hebrew word for giants, and it is right now trending online as people share this theory. Now, some people, because they don't know what Nephilim are, they're saying, well, it's UFOs, there's giants, and there's, you know, so on and so forth. Once again, whether or not all of this is true, I'm not going to speculate, but it is interesting that we live in a society where we're believing or claiming, or some people are claiming they're seeing such things. And I have a feeling that most of the people that are making these claims, these eyewitnesses or alleged eyewitnesses, are not as learned about the Bible as some of us might be. They may not know what Nephilim are. They may not know that in the end times there will be giants. Or that Nephilim are already walking the earth if we are in that time period, that biblical time period. And so why then would people suddenly be seeing this? Is this an illusion being put out by the forces against us? Is this something that is truly happening? Is this just people who just misunderstood what they saw? What they saw was misrepresented by all the fire, the lights, the fireworks, and all that jazz, and they just jumped to that conclusion? I don't know, but once again, it is interesting that a prophecy is being said to be being fulfilled, whether or not it is. Well, until the police catch and kill and reveal one of these 8 to 10 foot tall creatures, say, look what we found, we may never know. But anyway, so I thought this was an interesting story once again because it shows the state of our culture, our state of our society, where people are right now, what they're believing, what they think they're seeing, what they're expecting, because things have gotten so bad that we believe anything's possible. And maybe, just maybe, anything might be. All right, I'm going to take a real quick break. I'll be back after this.
The Constitution Association's website is at constitutionassociation.com. Constitution Association believes that the Constitution is the solution and the real hope for America. Be a hero in America's story. Make a difference. Protect, preserve, promote, restore the Constitution. Reclaim the Republic. Make America constitutional again. constitutionassociation.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth. Nothing more.
Okay, welcome back. Douglas V. Gibbs here. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com, DouglasVGibbs.com. Don't forget that this show is brought to you by you. You are the funding mechanism. DouglasVGibbs.com. Become a patron by going to the link there on the link bar that says join. Or you can donate to make sure this show is carrying on, that we keep on going. PayPal.com/PayPalMe/DouglasVGibbs. That's PayPal.com/PayPalMe/DouglasVGibbs. Or you can go to Venmo if you use Venmo. Douglas-Gibbs-3 and then 3975. I'm going to ask you for the last four of my phone number. Douglas-Gibbs-3, then 3975. Or you can go to Zelle, DouglasVGibbs@yahoo.com, and you can do the same thing with PayPal if you want to do it that way, DouglasVGibbs@yahoo.com. Either way, Zelle or PayPal.com, DouglasVGibbs@yahoo.com is how you can find me. All right, now, one of the things that we've been doing on this program is history, and I'll get to it at the end. We've been And it's been a few weeks because we've had other things pop up, but we've got you know, Soviets spying. You know, we've gotten into the post World War II part of our history book, which we're reading right here on the air. Now, that said, the book is finished. During the Christmas vacation, I completed the glossary and the timelines at the end of the chapters. And so all that's left is the bibliography and the index. So this book will go on sale probably in the next couple weeks. So be on the lookout for it. So the title of the book is A Promise of Truth, Self-Evident, Part 1, Early American History. And it's going to be three parts. This book is going to be well over 600 pages just for part one. If I was to publish all three parts together, it would probably be a 1,500-page book. So I'm publishing them in parts. So part one should be available in a matter of a couple weeks. Next week, I believe, we're going to start a pre-order program to, you know, for give people a discount if they want to order early. So pay attention to DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com, because that information will pop up there. But before we get into that history, we had been also starting to work through the Constitution of the United States. And we had done an episode about the preamble, an episode about Article 1, Section 1. And so I want to take off on Article 1, Section 2 today. That's where we are in our Constitution study. So if you got your pocket constitution with you, or your constitution on your computer, or a big old book with the constitution in it, whatever you got, Article 1, Section 2, and here's what it says. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. This is the creation of the House of Representatives. So Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution establishes the legislative branch. Article 1, Section 2 establishes the House of Representatives. Article 1, Section 3 establishes the United States Senate, two houses of the legislative branch, the Congress. Congress is a bicameral Congress, bicameral meaning two chambers. And so this is the first chamber, the House of Representatives. And as you'll see, as today, the people were... The members of the House of Representatives are democratically voted in, serving 2 years. And then when it says at the end that the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature, what that's saying is whatever the state determines is the eligibility requirement to be able to vote for the members of the state assembly or the state House of Representatives, whatever you want to call it. That same eligibility requirement applies for that voting for the House of Representatives. So whatever if they say you need to be a minimum of age 21 and you need to own $50 worth of property in order to vote for, you know, a member in your state House of Representatives, then that's the requirement in order to vote for the Federal House of Representatives. So then it gives our qualifications or eligibility requirements for these members of House of Representatives. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years or 25 years old for the member of the House. It's 30 for the Senate, it's 35 for the President. Notice it goes up in age with each step up in office. So for the House of Representatives, you need to be a minimum 25 years old and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. And it sounds like the way it's worded to most people, oh, it's saying you don't have to be a citizen of the state. No, it's saying the opposite. You need to be a resident of the state that you're representing, because there's no person at the beginning of that clause. It's double negative. But what it's saying is you need to be an inhabitant of the state in order to serve in the state of, in the United States House of Representatives. Now, that said, notice it doesn't say you have to be a resident of your district. So yes, it is possible for someone from some other district to run for House of Representatives in your district. Now, that said, it's frowned upon. The old term carpetbaggers comes to mind. Carpetbaggers during the war between the states were people who came down from the north into the south to inhabit positions because they knew it would be easy because the locals couldn't run because they had been tied to the quote-unquote rebellion or insurrection article. That's 14th Amendment, Section 3. Can't hold office if you've given a prior oath to the Constitution and then you rebelled against it. Or at least that's what was going on then. So the carpetbaggers came down and began to fill those spots. So being a carpetbagger typically is frowned upon, and sometimes it's not. For example, Maxine Waters does not live in the district that she represents. She used to, but then she got filthy rich being a member of the House and doesn't want to live in that neighborhood anymore, although she claims to be connected to the people of that district. So 2 years, 25 is 2 years term, 25 years old minimum. I need to be a citizen, an inhabitant of this of the district which you've chosen, and you need to have been 7 years a citizen. So it's not just that you need to have been a citizen, but you need to be 7 years a citizen. They don't want somebody who just came over here and still has not a full understanding of what America is about because they just got naturalized to suddenly run for office. We don't want the ideas, foreign ideas in our system. We want people who understand what it is to be an American. And so for the House of Representatives, the minimum time of being a citizen is 7 years. If you've not been a citizen at least 7 years, you're going to have to wait until you get to that 7 year point before you can run for office. All right, the next clause, and this is a considered controversial because it's been made controversial. Next clause in Article 1, Section 2 is a three-fifths clause. Now, I'm sure you've heard of it, and everybody says, well, that's proof that the Constitution is racist because it says that black people are three-fifths of a person. That's not what it says. It never said that. It never was intended to mean that. And even Frederick Douglass, an escaped slave, who later on freed himself, he escaped, and then his freedom was paid for by a couple of women from Britain because they loved what he was doing and loved his book when he went on a book tour to Britain. So they paid, they collected their money and they paid his quote-unquote master the amount of money that would be required to buy Frederick Douglass's freedoms. Even Frederick Douglass said, well, three-fifths clause does not show a pro-slavery or a racist attitude of the Constitution. If anything, it's the opposite. First of all, what it's saying is not that a black person is three-fifths of a person. What it's saying is that the three-fifths of the black, or not even the black, but the slave population, three-fifths of the slave population will be used to determine how many representatives the state has in the House of Representatives because it's based on population. So the question was, all right, so, you know, free people, full population, but what happens with the slave population? Should it be counted at all? Should it be counted in full? If it's counted in full as the southern states would want, then it would push the southern states to have the most power. The southern states, the pro-slavery states, have the most power in the House of Representatives. But the states, and realize all of the states were slave states at this point, but slavery was beginning to work its way out of the North. There were less slaves in the North. The abolition movements were getting they were moving along nicely in the North. And so because there was less slaves in the North, if slaves are counted as a whole, the northern states wouldn't have as big of a number as the southern states would. But if you counted the slaves as zero, well, because the southern states were rural, they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have the big cities and industrial areas and all that like the North did, then the North would dominate the House of Representatives. They would have the most representatives in the House of Representatives. And so both regions are saying, no, we're not going to be, trampled upon by the power of that other region because they have so much power in the House of Representatives. They were seeking a compromise. Well, they figured it out mathematically that if they established the requirements for the number of representatives when it came to slaves, that three-fifths of the slave population would be counted, that would make it about even. the North and the South would have about even power in the House. That way one wasn't dominating the other, which would give both of them a good reason to sign this document. Later on, Frederick Douglass, who I mentioned earlier, the escaped slave, who the ladies in Britain had bought his freedom, said that was actually also not only not racist, not pro-slavery, it was actually an anti-slavery move because it encouraged the abolition of slaves by the southern states. If you abolish the slavery, the slaves now are no longer figured at a 3/5 compromise, but now they count in full. So the number of representatives in the House of Representatives goes up for the southern states. So the southern states could gain power, gain more position in the House by simply freeing their slaves. It was an encouragement to abolish slavery. The House of Representatives, how it was apportioned is not the only thing that was three-fifths clause affected. Also affected taxes. The states paid an income tax based on their population. So if you had, let's say a state had 12% of the population, then at the end of the year, the state would pay 12% of the federal budget. Now, most of the money for the federal budget did come from tariffs and things like that. But things like tariffs weren't always enough to pay for the whole budget. So the states would pay a tax. Now, it was different than income tax today. Income tax today, the federal government takes their taxes from you if you don't, you know, because it's by the individual, direct taxation. And if you don't like it, tough. There will be a legal mechanism that will be used against you if you don't pay your taxes. But when it came to the states paying the tax, well, the federal government didn't take it from them like they take it from us. They requested it from the states. And if it's being requested, that means the states can say no. The states would say, wait a second, we don't like that in your budget. You better compromise with us. Fix your budget, we'll pay for it. And that's what sometimes would happen. And so a state, based on its population, would pay their taxes in relation to that. So that's also what the three-fifths clause was about. How much taxes a state would be paid that would pay would also be directly related to that number. So here's what it says, just for your information, to read the actual clause. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound for service for a term of years. In other words, indentured servants were counted as a whole number. And excluding Indians not taxed are ones that decided they're not going to be a member of the union. They're still going to be a part of their tribe. 3/5 of all other persons. Notice it doesn't say slaves, it says all other persons. They didn't want to denigrate these people any more than they've already had been by calling them something other than persons. Then it says the actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. That's the census, every 10 years. And it says 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States. Well, what they wound up doing is 3 years after the Constitutional Convention, because Congress actually convened in 1789, and 3 years would have been 1792, but the first census was actually in 1790, so it was actually 10 years from when they met the Constitutional Convention. And then it says the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, so you cannot have more than one representative for 30,000 people. Now, these representatives do now represent larger numbers than that because they put a freeze on how much the House of Representatives could grow, because if today it was, say, we were to follow one of the Bill of Rights amendments that was never ratified, that it was one per 30,000, we would have thousands of representatives. Thanks, but no thanks, I don't want a larger bureaucracy. Now, there are people who disagree with me, and they'll say, well, Doug, if they represent less people, they'll be more in tune with the people, and will listen to people more. If that was the case, then how do you explain city council members or HOA members of a board? Tyranny is tyranny, regardless of whether or not they represent 5 people, 10 people, 100 people, or 1,000 people. Tyrants will be tyrants. Now, that all said, then it says that each state shall have at least one representative. So, like, for example, Rhode Island has a very small population. They do have one representative. South Dakota has one representative. They cannot have zero. And then it goes on to say that, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island and Providence plantations 1, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3. That gives you an idea of the size of the states in relation to each other at the time. When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. In other words, if a vacancy appears in the House of Representatives, it is up to the governor to establish a special election to fill that seat to carry out the remainder of the term. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers. Notice it doesn't say that they have to be members of the House. It's up to them to choose anybody they want, but typically it is a member of the majority party and a member of the House of Representatives. And shall have the sole power of impeachment. The word impeachment does not mean remove from office. The word impeachment means to charge, to indict. So in other words, it is the House of Representatives' job to bring the indictment. That makes a lot of sense. In other words, if the people, the voice of the people, House of Representatives, they're democratically voted in, see a problem with somebody, they can then bring up charges. If they bring up charges, then, in other words, with a majority vote and the impeachment goes through, then the hearing is held by the Senate, which at the time was run by members who were appointed by the state legislatures. Voice of the People, House, Voice of the States, U.S. Senate. The voice of the people could charge. It took the voice of the states to carry on or to carry out the hearing. And that, my friends, brings us to Article 1, Section 3, which we'll save for another time, probably next week on this program. And so let me take another quick break, and then after the break, we're going to go through our history lesson, something we haven't done in a while. It's time to get caught up again. So don't go anywhere. Be right back, and we will go through our history lesson from the history book that, remember, I have finished everything except for the bibliography and the index. It is literally weeks, if not less than a couple weeks away from publication. Be right back. Don't go anywhere.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
Hi, this is Douglas V. Gibbs, advocate for restoring the Constitutional Republic and host of the Mr. Constitution Hour on K-Praise, San Diego, 9 p.m. Saturdays. Attacks against liberty around the world are increasing. The enemies of liberty have infiltrated the halls of government, and they have conquered every institution we need to restore the biblical and constitutional foundation of America. Leftism is putting the squeeze on our liberty and personal well-being. It's not hopeless. I have been planting strategy, information, and establishing tactical hubs around America. Faith, education, advocacy, restoration. Check out my books, including my latest, Repeal Democracy. Listen to the Mr. Constitution Hour on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. on K-Praise and become a $9 per month patron at douglasvgibbs.com. Help fuel the movement that has the anti-liberty left on the run. Go to douglasvgibbs.com. Click join, click patron, become a member of the movement. Let's work together on the strategies to save America. douglasvgibbs.com. Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs is finally available. Doug's latest book examines the importance of being a republic, why, how we can restore a republic, and why democracy is so dangerous. Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. C.S. Lewis. And that is the very first page that you will see right before Chapter 1 in Repeal Democracy. Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs. On sale now.
Are the socialists. You will be assimilated. Your individual liberties, personal freedoms, and mental individuality will be added to our own. Resistance is futile.
right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. All right, welcome back. Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution, douglasvgibbs.com. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, KPRZ.com. And you can find podcasts all over the place, Amazon Prime, Spotify, Odyssey, Audible, iHeartRadio, the list goes on and on. All right, so where we left off, about 4 or 5 weeks ago, in our history lesson, is we had gotten to, we are in post-war, post-World War II era, and we have concerns because communism is on the rise in the United States, is infiltrating. There are spies here, and we're post-World War II, so I'm going to pick up where I left off from last time. As Roosevelt was courting Stalin, M. Stanton Evans writes, Stalin had help from his vast networks of spies in the United States. Not just Soviet spies, but American spies, most of whom had secretly joined the Communist Party of the United States, Communist Party USA, CPUSA. More than 300 communist members or supporters had infiltrated the American government and worked in the Lend-Lease, the Treasury Department, and State Department, the Office of the President, the Office of the Vice President, and even American Intelligence Operations, the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. These spies not only relayed information to the KGB, they constantly tried to shift U.S. policy in a pro-Soviet direction. The opening of the Soviet archives in 1995 revealed the extensive espionage network that effectively operated inside the U.S. government. The Communist Party USA launched in 1919, but serious infiltration began in the 1930s. They supported FDR's recognition of the Soviet Union and embedded themselves in America's bureaucracy with experience working for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, AAA, the National Recovery Administration, NRA, and the Treasury Department. Writings of former spies, Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley, reveals how state documents were copied or microfilmed and delivered to Soviet government leaders. By World War II, these spies were well positioned to influence policy, or at least explain policy. Just in time for Roosevelt to embrace Uncle Joe, Joseph Stalin, as his buddy. Stalin with his spies and Roosevelt following his every request planned his tactics carefully and successfully. Spy and London School of Economics educated economist Lachlan Curry had direct access to Roosevelt during the 1930s and during World War II. In June of 1944, Curry cabled the New York KGB that Roosevelt was willing to concede half of Poland to Stalin and that FDR was willing to pressure the Polish government in exile to cooperate with the Russians. According to H. Stanton Evans, Harry Dexter White operated in the Treasury Department, passing information to the Soviets during the 1930s and was influential in the hiring of at least 11 communists in the Treasury Department, including Lachlan Curry. During World War II, White influenced tax policy and foreign policy as Assistant Director, Secretary of the Treasury. Historians have uncovered 15 KGB messages that White sent to Russian intelligence officers late in the war. White told the Soviets that Roosevelt would give only limited backing to the Polish government in exile and would not resist the Soviet Union if it decided to annex Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. After Roosevelt died, White met with key Soviet intelligence men and told them the Soviets could press for veto power in the newly created United Nations, the UN, because Truman and Stettinius wanted to achieve the success of the UN conference at any price. Evans also explains the most famous American spy for the Soviets was Alger Hiss, who worked his way from a government official in the AAA to head of the Office of Special Political Affairs in the State Department. Educated at Johns Hopkins and Harvard Law School, Hiss clerked for Oliver Wendell Holmes and entered government with seemingly impeccable credentials. During the 1930s, he passed documents to the Soviets, and during the war, he became a part of the Roosevelt team that went to Yalta to negotiate with Stalin over Poland. In 1939, Whitaker Chambers quit spying for the Soviets and changed his allegiance. He provided in detail who the communist sympathizers in government were, but the Roosevelt administration dismissed Chambers as a crank, and nothing was done with his revelations during the war. At the Yalta conference in February of 1945, the final meeting of Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, Roosevelt provided even more advantages to the Soviet Union. The location was near Stalin's summer hideaway, and again, Roosevelt stayed in a room that was bugged, which means the Soviets listened to all of his conversations. When Stalin asked one of his spies about the conversations Roosevelt was having, the response was, "Do they know that we are listening to them? It's bizarre. They say everything in the fullest detail." Stalin was well prepared due to the bugging and the fact that Alger Hiss was in the American delegation at Yalta. Yalta yielded Soviet entrance into the war with Japan and a major partnership by the Soviet Union in the future United Nations, which Stalin agreed to provide that Russia had veto power in the Security Council. By the end of the meeting, Stalin had also secured his dominance over Eastern Europe, including a chunk of Berlin and Eastern Germany. The agreement handed over Poland to Stalin, and with its provisions, would keep Great Britain and France weak. Roosevelt asked for free elections, at least in Poland, and Stalin promised it would be so. However, free elections meant one thing to Roosevelt and Churchill, and something entirely different to Stalin. By the end of the Yalta conference, Stalin was able to secure Soviet control over Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and a portion of Germany, and other territories from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic. The Iron Curtain and the Cold War was set and established by Roosevelt before Truman's speech declared the Truman Doctrine would resist communist uprisings in Europe. At Yalta, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin agreed to maintain spheres of influence in Asia. The Soviets were given the northern part of Asia, including North Korea and Manchuria. The Americans took care of southern China and South Korea below the 38th parallel. Britain would continue its lease of Hong Kong. A civil war or revolution, depending on who you talk to, occurred in China from 1911 to 1945. In 1937, when Japan occupied parts of China, the war was interrupted, and the communists and the nationalists joined together for a moment to fight the common enemy, Japan. In 1946, the war in China resumed. The United States sent the nationalist aid, and the Soviet Union gave support to the communists. In 1949, Chiang Kai-shek, China's president, and his forces were defeated by the communists when Mao's troops crossed the Yangtze River and captured the capital city of Nanking. Those loyal to Chiang were forced to evacuate, and the nationalists fled from the mainland to the island of Taiwan, Formosa, where the true Chinese government in exile was established. The United States played only a minor role, despite wiping out the Japanese imperialists in World War II, and the U.S. refused to get involved in China's civil war. Congress blamed the loss of China on policy errors and incompetent diplomacy. Intervention would have likely required a full-scale buildup, equivalent to that of 1942 when the United States entered World War II, along with a relenting use of atomic bombs, and it would only have worked out successfully if the Soviet Union decided not to intervene themselves. Weary of war, the Americans didn't have the resolve to engage in another major war, much less risk the wrath of their new communist enemy in the Soviet Union. Secretary of State Dean Acheson, once China was lost to the communists, gave a speech during which he discussed the readjusting of the maps of Asia. He implied during the speech that Korea was no longer considered to be within the U.S. containment fence. Kim Il-sung of North Korea, who had taken control of the North in 1948 after helping establish the Soviet-run northern part of the peninsula, establishing North Korea as a communist country, viewed Acheson's words as being a suggestion that the southern part of the Korean peninsula might be obtained at a minimal price. Arguing that the southern Korean nationalist leader, Syngman Rhee, might move on the north to unify two Koreas, Kim launched a general attack on June 25, 1950. The attack was a decisive victory for the communists in the north. President Truman finally decided stopping communism was an important move, commenting that the United States, the U.S., finally needed to stop the North Koreans no matter what. So while the United States had shied away from a land war in China, Korea was something different. Its small size and abundant coastline played in America's naval advantage. Japan, now, you know, before I get started there, I'm going to save the Korean War for next week. So we have now established that the communists have infiltrated the United States at this point. The World War II is over, but the Soviet Union was being given property throughout Eastern Europe. The Iron Curtain went up. Germany split into two pieces. Berlin split into two pieces. And we didn't listen to our generals. General MacArthur and General Patton both said, let's keep on going into China. Let's keep on going into Russia. Otherwise, communism will be a problem in the future. That advice wasn't followed. Those people were actually eliminated for what they believed and forced to retire, fired, whatever you want to call it. And we wound up with a full-blown Cold War and also the Korean War and Vietnam War. So next week, Korean War in our history portion. We'll have Article 1, Section 3 of the United States Constitution and, of course, any other news items that pop up. So, once again, thank you for spending the time with me. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com, douglasvgibbs.com. Once again, if you can help out with funding the show, it's important. Go to douglasvgibbs.com, become a patron, $9 a month. Be a patron, help fund the effort. You know, just hit the join link there at douglasvgibbs.com, or you can go to Zelle or to PayPal using douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com, douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com, or you can go to Venmo, douglas-gibbs-3. That's douglas-gibbs-3. And then when I ask you for the last four of my phone number, 3975. All right, so thanks for spending the time with me. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. We'll see you next time right here on KPRZ. Have a great week.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.